I first IOIs and learned that the 10 was Rebecca and the 11 was Heather. Now it was time to separate the two of them and see if I could get enough IOIs to kiss close Heather. A guy they knew suddenly showed up and bought 3 shots for Heather, Rebecca, and himself. I held out my empty hand and looked around, pretending to be hurt. Heather, who I was slowly realizing was actually a sweet girl beneath that laboriously wrought exterior, took the bait. "Don't mind him," she said, pointing to their guy friend. "He's just rude." As she called the bartender over and ordered me a shot, Rebecca threw her a dirty look. "Remember our rule?" she whined. I knew what their rule was. Girls like this love it when guys buy them drinks. But girls also don't respect guys who buy them drinks. A true pickup artist knows never to buy meals, drinks, or gifts for a girl he hasn't slept with. Dating is for tools. "We promised not to buy any drinks on this trip," Rebecca whined. "But you're not buying a drink for yourself," I told them. "You're buying one for me, and I'm different from all the other guys." I'm not really that arrogant, but in the game there are rules, and the rules must be obeyed because they work. Suddenly, Mystery walked toward me and whispered in my ear, "Isolate." "I want to show you something," I said to Heather as I took her by the hand. I led her to a nearby booth, sat her down, and performed the ESP experiment. Behind me, I saw Mystery punching his fist into his open hand in slow motion. It was a code, the signal to phase shift, to slow down and move in for the kill. I told her about soul gazing, and, with house music and dozens of conversations blaring around us, we stared into each other's eyes and shared a moment together. In my head, I imagined her as the pudgy middle school student she used to be. If I'd been thinking about how beautiful she really was, I would have been too nervous to sully her with my lips, as I was about to attempt to do. I slowly moved my head toward hers. "No lips," she said quietly. I held up my index finger, placed it against her lips, and said, "Shh." Then I kissed her on the lips. It would have been the most beautiful kiss of my life, but I was so lost in the seduction that I forgot I was wearing a fake lip ring. Worried that it would fall out, or even worse, end up on her lip, I pulled back, looked at her again, and then nibbled on her upper lip. Her tongue darted out of her mouth. "Hey, not so fast," I told her, as if she were the one hitting on me. The key to physical escalation, David D'Angelo had said in his seminar, is always 2 steps forward, 1 step back. We made out carefully, and then I returned her to Rebecca at the bar. I had a workshop to wing, so I told them both that it was a pleasure meeting them and I should rejoin my friends. We confirmed our plans to spend a weekend together, and I left with my heart singing. The Matador of Love was the first person to run up to me. He took my hand in his and kissed it. "In India, we put ourselves prostrate before people like you," he said, flapping his arms excitedly. "You've given me a new meaning on life. It was like watching John Elway do the 2-minute drive. You knew he had game before, but in that moment, he really proved it. You got the Super Bowl ring." For the rest of the night, I was on fire. Women who hadn't even seen me with the Platinum Non-Sisters were opening me. They could smell it. It didn't even matter whether I got laid or not, because this was the game artfully played. It was exactly what I'd been working so hard for. I just didn't realize that I'd ever be able to pull it off so smoothly, or that in the process, I was creating a hunger that could never be satiated. Chapter 3. When I came home from my travels with Mystery, Dustin was waiting in my apartment for me. The king of the naturals had returned. But what was he doing in my apartment? "Hi," he said in his soft, effeminate voice. He was wearing a tweed sport coat with large brown buttons, straight-legged polyester black slacks, and a black skull cap. I hadn't talked to Dustin in more than a year, since before I had joined the community. Last I'd heard, he was managing a nightclub in Russia. He had sent me photos of his girlfriends, one for each night of the week. He actually referred to them as Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and so on. How'd you get in here? Your landlady, Louise, let me in. She's really a sweet person. Her son's a writer too, you know. He had a way of making people comfortable with him. It's good to see you, by the way, he said as he gave me a big bear hug. When he pulled away, his eyes were misty, as if it really were good to see me again. The feeling was mutual. Dustin had been on my mind every day as I learned the pickup arts. Where Ross Jeffries needed spoken hypnotic patterns to convince a woman to explore her fantasies with him, Dustin was able to achieve the same result without uttering a word. He was a blank male canvas for a woman to project her repressed desires onto, even if she didn't consciously know what they were prior to meeting him. I never had the resources to understand how he operated before, but now, with my new knowledge, I could watch him work, ask questions, and eventually model his process. I could usher a whole new school of thought into the pickup community. I don't know if I've told you what I've been doing the past year, I said, but I've been hanging out with the world's greatest pickup artists. My whole life has changed. I get it now. I know, he said. Marco told me. He looked at me with big, wet, brown eyes, the ones that had gazed into the souls of countless beautiful women. I don't, he paused. I don't really do that anymore. I looked at him, incredulously at first, but then I noticed that the round black skullcap on his head was a yarmulke. I live in Jerusalem now, he continued, in a yeshiva. It's a religious school. You're kidding. No, I haven't had sex for 8 months. It's not allowed. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. The king of the naturals had gone celibate. It couldn't be true. Wasn't that why prisons were invented? They offered men food, clothing, shelter, television, and fresh air, but deprived them of the two things that really mattered, freedom and women. Are you allowed to masturbate at least? No. Really? He paused. Well, sometimes when I sleep, I have wet dreams. See? God is trying to tell you something. It has to come out. He laughed and patted me on the back. His gestures were slow and his laugh condescending, as if he had spiritually bypassed toilet humor. I go by my Hebrew name now, he said. It was given to me by one of the highest rabbis at the yeshiva. It's Avisha. I was stunned. How could Dustin transform so suddenly from nightclub player to rabbinical student, especially now that I needed him most? So what made you give up women? I asked. When you can get any girl you want, every guy, even if he's rich or famous, looks at you in a different way because you have something he doesn't, he said. But after a while, I'd bring girls home and I didn't want to have sex with them anymore. I just wanted to talk. So we'd talk all night and bond on a very deep level, and then I'd walk them to the subway in the morning. That's when I started to leave it behind. I realized that I got my entire validation from women. Women became like gods to me, but false gods. So I went to find the real God. Sitting in his Moscow apartment, he said, he searched the internet for guidance until he came across the Torah and started reading. After an eye-opening trip to Jerusalem, he returned to Russia and went to a casino party, where the mafia, corrupt businessmen, and materialistic hangers-on sickened him in comparison with the people he'd met in Israel. So he packed his bags, left his week's worth of girlfriends, and arrived in Jerusalem on the eve of Passover. I stopped by, he said, to ask your forgiveness for some of my past actions. I had no idea what he was talking about. He'd always been a great friend. I idealized a lifestyle and behavior that were corrupt, he explained. I abhorred kindness, mercy, human dignity, and intimacy. Instead, I used, degraded, and exploited women. I thought only about my pleasure. I despised the good instincts within me and within others, and attempted to corrupt anyone I met. As he spoke, I couldn't help thinking that all these things he was apologizing for were the very reasons I had befriended him in the first place. I promoted and dragged you into this whole pickup thing, as if what I was doing were the highest ideal a person could live for, he went on. So, to whatever extent I am guilty of affecting the natural goodness of your soul, I am deeply sorry. It all made sense intellectually, but I've never trusted extremes, whether it be drug addiction, religious fanaticism, or zero-carb diets. There was something odd about Dustin, or Avisha. He had a hole he was trying to fill, first with women, now with religion. I listened to him, but I had a different opinion. I accept your apology, I told him, but with a caveat that you have nothing to apologize for. He looked at me softly, but didn't say anything. I could see why he was so seductive. It was those eyes that glistened like the surface of a mountain lake, that intense power of focus, that way of making you believe that nothing else existed for him except what you were saying at that very moment. Think about it, I continued. If a guy wants to improve his odds of meeting women, he's going to have to make some changes to himself. And it just so happens that all the qualities women look for in guys are good things. I mean, I've become more confident. I started working out and eating healthier. I'm getting in touch with my emotions and learning more about spirituality. I've become a more fun, positive person. He looked at me, listening patiently. And I'm not just more successful with women now. I'm more successful in every other human interaction, from dealing with my landlord to handling credit card overcharges. Still looking. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that I'm learning how to pick up women, sure, but in the process, I'm becoming a better human being. His mouth began to move. He was going to speak. Well, he said. Yes, what? I am eternally here for you as a true friend and also to make up for what I did. He wasn't convinced. Fuck him. I was going to take a nap. Mind if I stay over for a couple days? He asked. No problem, but I'm leaving for Australia on Wednesday. Do you have an alarm clock I can borrow? I need to pray with the sunrise. After I found him a small travel clock, he reached into his bag and pulled out a book. Here, he said, I brought this for you. It was a small hardcover edition of a 16th century book called The Path of the Just, with a note he had written for me, inscribed on the title page. It quoted the Talmud. Whoever destroys a single life is as guilty as though he had destroyed the entire world, and whoever rescues a single life earns as much merit as though he had rescued the entire world. So he was trying to save me. Why? I was having fun. Chapter 4. The day had arrived. This would be the most monumental trip of my seduction career. First, I was going to Toronto for a workshop Mystery was giving to Papa, a friend of Exotic Options from the Belgrade workshop. Papa was paying $1,500 for the privilege of hanging out one-on-one with Mystery and I. Afterward, Mystery wanted to get a tattoo with me, a heart on the wrist that would be the international symbol of Puas everywhere. Then we were going to take the bus to New York for Mystery's first classroom seminar, and finally, fly to Bucharest so that Mystery could implement what he called Project Bliss. He wanted to return to Eastern Europe, find two young bisexual women searching for a better life overseas, and seduce them. He planned to get them student visas, take them back to Canada, and train them to become strippers, girlfriends, and eventually magic assistants. Tattoos and white slavery. That's where self-improvement had led me. On my way out of the house, I checked my mailbox. Along with the usual overdue bills and raised car insurance notices was a postcard of the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem. Your Hebrew name is Tuvia, it said. The writing was Dustin's. It comes from the word Tav, or good. Its opposite is Ra, or evil. And in Hebrew, Tav also means that which endures, and Ra is that which is short-lived. So your essence is connected to a desire to search out and connect to that which endures, the good. but sometimes you get stuck at the bad along the way. On the flight, I reread the postcard. Dustin was trying to give me a message from God, and maybe he had a point. But, on the other hand, I'd had an enduring wish, ever since adolescence, for the power to seduce any woman I wanted. Now I was getting my wish. This was good. This was Tav. Mystery had recently gotten his own place in Toronto, with a pua named Number 9, a Korean computer geek who, thanks to Mystery's ever-present advice, had turned himself into a relatively cool-looking guy. They lived in a cramped two-bedroom apartment above a cyber cafe near the University of Toronto. Since Number 9 was out of town, I put my bags in his room and joined Mystery in the kitchen. Patricia had broken up with him, for good this time, and he'd been staying in his room a lot, playing a video game called Morrowind and downloading lesbian porn. Getting out of the house for these upcoming workshops would be good therapy for him. There were three types of people who signed up for the workshops. There were guys like Exotic Option from Belgrade, who were normal and well-adjusted socially, but wanted to have greater flexibility and choice in meeting girls. There were guys who were uptight and set in their ways, like Cliff of Cliff's List, who couldn't even handle having a nickname like everybody else. They tended to gather as much knowledge as they could, but had trouble making even the smallest behavioral change. And then there were people like Papa, approach machines who compensated for a lack of social skills with a lack of social fears. Approach machines tended to improve the fastest, simply by following the flowchart of material they were given. But once they ran out of material, they floundered. And this was going to be Papa's challenge. He was a soft-spoken Chinese pre-law student. He wore a checked button-down shirt and jeans that were a size too large. They always seemed to arrive in a checked button-down shirt and oversized jeans. And they always left in a loud shiny shirt, tight black synthetic pants, silver rings, and sunglasses pushed up on their heads. It was the player uniform, designed to convey sexuality, which was evidently synonymous with cheesiness. Mystery and I sat down with Papa at a cafe and asked the usual questions. What's your score? What would you like it to be? What are your sticking points? Well, I used to be the social chair of my fraternity, he began, and I come from a lot of money. My father is the president of a major university. Let me cut you off right there, I said. You're qualifying yourself to us. Instead of gaining our admiration, all you're doing is displaying lower status. A rich man doesn't have to tell you he's rich. Papa nodded stupidly. His head seemed to be surrounded by a dense, invisible fog, which made his reaction time just a little slower than most people's. It gave the impression that he wasn't all there. Is it okay if I record everything you're saying? Papa asked, struggling to pull a small digital recorder out of his pocket. There are certain bad habits we've groomed our whole life, from personality flaws to fashion faux pas, and it has been the role of parents and friends, outside of some minor tweaking, to reinforce the belief that we're okay just as we are. But it's not enough to just be yourself. You have to be your best self. And that's a tall order if you haven't found your best self yet. That's why the workshops were so life-transforming. We told each student the first impression he made. We weren't afraid of hurting his feelings. We corrected his every gesture, phrase, and item of clothing, because we knew he wasn't living up to his potential. None of us is. We get stuck in old thought and behavior patterns that may have been effective when we were 12 months or 12 years old, but now only serve to hold us back. And while those around us may have no problem correcting our minor flaws, they let the big ones slide, because it would mean attacking who we are. But who are we, really? Just a bundle of good genes and bad genes, mixed with good habits and bad habits. And since there's no gene for coolness or confidence, then being uncool and unconfident are just bad habits, which can be changed with enough guidance and willpower. And that was Papa's asset, willpower. He was an only child and used to taking any measure necessary to get what he wanted. I demonstrated some of my best routines on him. The jealous girlfriend opener, the best friends test, the cube, and a new piece I'd made up involving C-shaped smiles, you shape smiles, and the personality characteristics each conveyed. Papa recorded every word on his digital recorder. He would later transcribe them, memorize them, and ultimately use my exact words to pick up Paris Hilton. I should have recognized the signals then. I should have realized what was going on. This wasn't teaching. It was cloning. Mystery and I were traveling around the world making miniature versions of ourselves, and we would soon pay for it. Every piece of material we gave Papa, he used. Every error we pointed out, he corrected instantly. With each successful set, he seemed to grow an inch taller. Instead of summer school, he told me, he'd spent 3 months working on speed seduction skills. But until this workshop, he'd never seen real puas in the field before. On our last day with Papa, we went to a club called Government. I pushed him into sets and watched him repeat, like a robot, the openers, routines, and negs Mystery and I had taught him. And women were responding to him now. It was amazing how effective just a few simple lines could be, and it was also a little depressing. The first thing aspiring stand-up comics do is develop a tight 5-minute routine that can win over any audience. But after seeing hundreds of rooms fill with laughter on cue at the exact same points, they begin to lose respect for their audience for being so easily manipulated. Being a successful pickup artist meant risking the same side effect. When Papa left to get some sleep before his flight home, Mystery and I stayed at the club to continue sarging. Grimble had recently given me the idea of taking all the scraps of paper with phone numbers I'd collected and putting them under glass on a coffee table for decoration. But as I was sharing the idea with Mystery, he cut me off. Proximity alert system, he announced. When women stand near a man, but facing away from him, especially when there's no real reason for them to be hanging out in that particular spot, it trips what Mystery calls the proximity alert system. It means they're interested. They want to be opened. Mystery wheeled around and started talking to a delicate blonde in a strapless dress and a muscular brunette in a do-rag. When he introduced me, he told them I was an amazing illusionist. We'd been winging together for months now, so I knew just what to do. Fake them out with a couple of the practical jokes and pseudo-magic tricks I learned in elementary school. In the field, one quickly learns that everything that was funny at age 10 is funny all over again. Mystery had brought along a video camera, so he began taping the interaction. The girls didn't seem to mind. As he isolated the brunette, I talked to the blonde. Her name was Caroline. Her friend was Carly. Caroline lived in the suburbs with her family. Her goal in life was to be a nurse, but she was currently working at Hooters, despite having breasts the size of sweet tarts and a shy, withdrawn personality. From 2 feet away, Caroline's face seemed alabaster. From 1 foot away, I noticed it was dappled with pinprick freckles. One of her teeth was crooked. She had a red mark on the skin over her collarbone, as if she'd been itching it. She smelled like cotton. She had gotten a manicure in the last 24 hours. She weighed no more than 100 pounds. Her favorite color was probably pink. I observed all these things as my mouth moved, reciting the routines I'd told to hundreds of girls before. What was different about Caroline was that the routines didn't seem to be working. I just couldn't reach what I call the hook point, which is when a woman you've approached decides she enjoys your company and doesn't want you to leave. Though I stood just a foot away from Caroline, a mile-wide chasm separated us. After watching the movie Boiler Room, about ruthless, cold-calling stockbrokers, Mystery had decided that phone numbers were wood. In other words, they were useless. Our new strategy was to no longer try to call a girl for a date, but to take her on a date right away, an instant date, to a nearby bar or restaurant. Changing venues quickly became a key piece in the pickup game. It created a sense of distorted time. If you went to 3 places with a group you'd just met, by the end of the night, it felt as if you'd all known each other forever. "Why don't we all grab a bite to eat?" Mystery suggested. We walked to a diner nearby, arm in arm with our instant dates. During the meal, everything suddenly clicked in the group. Carly felt comfortable enough to unleash her biting wit, and Caroline began to radiate empathy and warmth. We didn't need any routines or tactics. We all just made fun of ourselves and each other. Afterward, Carly invited us to call a cab from her apartment around the corner. She had just moved in, and the rooms were bare of furniture, so Mr. and I sat on the floor. We didn't call a cab, and the girls didn't remind us to, which we took as an IOI. Carly soon left the room with Mystery, giving Caroline tacit permission to fool around with me. As we wrapped ourselves around each other, the chasm that had separated us in the bar disappeared. Caroline's touch was soft and gentle, her body frail and forgiving. Now I understood why it had been so difficult to get rapport with her when we'd first met. She didn't communicate with words. She communicated with feelings. She'd make a great nurse. After Caroline brought in some blankets to make the hardwood floor a little more comfortable, I went down on her. I stacked her orgasms as Steve P. had taught me, until it seemed like her body was melting into the ground. But when I reached for a condom afterward, I heard the four words that had taken the place of "let's just be friends" in my life. "But I just met you." It was a much sweeter sound, and there was no reason to push for sex with Caroline. I knew I'd see her again. She lay on my shoulder, and we enjoyed the afterglow. She was 19, she said, and hadn't had sex in almost 2 years. The reason? She had a 1-year-old child at home. His name was Carter, and she was determined not to be another neglectful teenage mother. This was the first time she'd been apart from him for a weekend. When we awoke the next afternoon, awkward from the passion of the night before, Caroline suggested having breakfast at a restaurant next door. In the days that followed, I must have watched Mystery's video of that breakfast 100 times. At the diner the night before, Caroline's blue eyes were flat and distant. But at breakfast in the morning, they glittered and danced when she looked at me. Whenever I made a joke, even one that wasn't funny, a broad smile spread across her face. Something inside her heart had opened. It was, I realized, the first time I'd made a real emotional connection with a woman since I'd started picking them up. I don't have a particular type of girl I'm attracted to, the way some guys are Asian fetishists or Jessica Simpson fetishists. But of all the women in the world, the last type I ever thought I'd fall for would be a 19-year-old, single mom who waited tables at Hooters. But the great thing about the heart is that it has no master, despite what reason may think. When we returned home, Mystery and I loaded the footage of Carly and Caroline into Mystery's computer and proceeded to spend the next 6 hours self-indulgently editing it into a 6-minute video. When we finished, I called Caroline and she picked us up that evening. After dinner, we brought Carly and Caroline back to Mystery's house. As she watched the video, Caroline couldn't stop smiling. I brought her into Number 9's room afterward, and we lay on the bed and slowly undressed each other. Her body trembled with so much emotion that it seemed to dissipate beneath me. It felt like making love to a cloud. When she came, she didn't make a sound. As we lay together afterward, Caroline rolled away from me. She stared at the wall and grew distant. I knew what she was thinking. When I asked her about it, she burst into tears. "I gave it up too fast," she sobbed. "Now I'm never going to see you again." They were such sweet words because they were so honest. I slid my arm under her and placed her head on my shoulder. I told her, first of all, that every passionate relationship I've ever had began passionately. It was a line I'd learned from Mystery, but I did believe it. Second, I told her that maybe she shouldn't have, but she wanted to and needed to. It was a line I'd learned from Ross Jeffries, but I did believe it. Third, I told her that I was more mature than a lot of the people she'd been with before, so not to judge me by her past experiences. It was a line I'd learned from David D'Angelo, but I did believe it. Finally, I told her that I'd be sad if I never saw her again. It wasn't a line. When we finally emerged into the front room, we found Carly and Mystery wrapped around each other in a blanket. Caroline and I spooned on the couch next to them, and together we watched an episode of The Osbournes on Mystery's computer, each basking in our own postcoital glow. It was a beautiful moment. and it wouldn't last. Chapter 5. There is nothing more bonding than successfully picking up girls together. It is the basis for a great friendship. Because afterward, when the girls are gone, you can finally give each other the high five that you've been holding back since you met them. It is the sweetest high five in the world. It's not just the sound of skin hitting skin. It's the sound of brotherhood. "You know what's so fucked up?" Mystery said. "I feel so bad, and then a girl sleeps with me and likes me, and bam, I'm on top of the world again." Smack. "So?" Mystery asked. "So? Are you ready to commit to this lifestyle?" "I thought I was committed." "No, for life. It's in your blood now. You and me, we have to challenge each other. Of all the guys I've met, you're my only competition. No one else has the chance to reach the throne except you. When I was a teenager, I'd lie awake in bed, praying to God, please don't let me die before having sex. I just want to see what it feels like. But now, I had a different dream. At night, I'd lie in bed and ask God to just let me have the opportunity to be a father before I die. I've always lived for experience, traveling, learning new skills, meeting new people. But having a child is the ultimate experience. It's what we're here for. And despite my rakish behavior, I hadn't lost sight of that. Yet, at the same time, living for experiences also means wanting the novelty and adventure of dating different women. I can't imagine ever choosing one person for life. It's not that I'm scared of commitment. It's that I'm scared of arguing with someone I love over whose turn it is to do the dishes, of losing the desire to have sex with a woman lying next to me every night, of taking a back seat in her heart to our children, of resenting someone for limiting my freedom to be selfish. This pickup thing had never been about sowing my wild oats. My oats are always going to be wild, and that's not necessarily something I relish. I'm screwing up my chances of being a cool dad. If I'd married my first girlfriend and had kids with her, they'd be, say, 8 and 10 now, and I'd be an excellent father, able to relate to them on nearly every level. But it's too late for me now. By the time my kids are 10, I'll be well into my 40s. I'll be so out of touch, they'll make fun of my taste in music and beat me at arm wrestling. And now, I was really going to screw up my chances of getting married. I was about to brand myself a player for life. An hour later, Mystery and I were outside Fine Line Tattoo on Kingston Road. I was smarter than this, I thought. But it's easy to get caught up in the moment, in the hand slap, in the brotherhood. I turned the handle of the door and pushed. It didn't open. Though it was 3 o'clock on a Monday afternoon, the shop was closed. "Damn," Mystery said. "Let's find somewhere else." I'm not a superstitious person, but when I'm on the fence about an idea, it only takes a slight draft to push me in either direction. "I can't go through with this," I said. "What's wrong?" "I have problems with commitment. I don't think I can even commit to a tattoo that signifies a lack of commitment." My neurotic nature had saved me for once. The next night, Caroline drove to Mystery's house, and we all went out for sushi. "Where's Carly?" Mystery asked. Caroline flushed and looked into her tea. She couldn't make it, she said. "She says hi, though." I could see Mystery's body language change. He slumped in his chair and pressed further. "Did she say why? Is there a problem?" "Well," Caroline said, she's with her boyfriend." Mystery's face went pale. "And she wouldn't come? Carly said you and she were very different anyway." Mystery went quiet. He didn't speak for another 10 minutes. Whenever we asked a question to draw him out, he responded monosyllabically. It wasn't that he loved Carly. He just hated rejection. He was experiencing the downside of seducing a woman with a boyfriend. She usually went back to him afterward. And seeing Caroline and I enjoying each other's company so much only rubbed it in. "I'm the world's greatest pickup artist," he grumbled in my direction. How come I don't have a girlfriend? Well, maybe because you're the world's greatest pickup artist. After a long period of silence, Mystery asked Caroline to drive him to the strip club where his ex-girlfriend, Patricia, worked. She dropped him off in the parking lot and then took me to spend the night at the house in the suburbs where she lived with her mother, sister, and brother. It would be my first time meeting her family. Her mother greeted us at the door. In her arms was a crying baby, my teenage girlfriend's baby. "Do you want to hold him?" Caroline asked. I suppose the stereotypical reaction would be to say that I was scared, that reality sunk in, that I wanted to get out of there. But I didn't. I wanted to hold him. It was kind of cool. This was what I got into the game for, to have these kinds of adventures, to hold a baby in my arms for the first time and wonder, what does his mother expect of me? Chapter 6. While I was playing daddy with Caroline, Mystery was spiraling. Dropping him off at the strip club was a bad move. Seeing Patricia had fucked him up. Not only would she not take him back, but she also told him that she'd started dating other people. "She's been working out 3 hours a day," he said over the phone. "She lost 15 pounds, and her ass is a 10, dude. The things a chick will do when she's angry. Damn." "Don't think about how good she looks," I advised. "Look for the flaws and blow those up in your mind. It'll make it easier. I know that intellectually, but emotionally I'm fucked up. I feel like I'm being raked over coals. It all came crashing down on me when I saw her again. That hot body, the tan lines. She was the hottest stripper in the place. And I can't have her. Carly's back with her boyfriend, and I'm beat from trying to make my new place livable. For what? Dude, you're a pickup artist. There are hundreds more just like Patricia out there, and you can get them in a night. I'm not a pickup artist. I'm a lover. I love women. I swear, I don't even think about threesomes anymore. I would be so happy to settle for Patricia now. I've got Patricia withdrawal on the mind. I miss her every minute of the day." Mystery had hardly thought about Patricia or talked about her until she rejected him. Now he was obsessed. His own theories on attraction had come back to slap him in the face. Patricia was doing a takeaway. But for her, it wasn't a technique. It was for real. As a magician used to exploiting the gullibility of others, Mystery had no patience with anything spiritual or supernatural. His religion was Darwin. Love to him was simply an evolutionary impulse that enabled human beings to fulfill their two primary objectives, to survive and replicate. He called that impulse pair bonding. "It's strange how strong pair bonding is," he said. "I feel so alone now. I'll tell you what, we'll pick you up tomorrow and you can play in the suburbs with us. It'll cheer you up." Caroline and I put Carter in his stroller and pushed him around the block to a park. As I sat down on the bench, I thought about what a pathetic couple of pickup artists Mystery and I were. Kids around the world thought we were in hot tubs, surrounded by bikini-clad models. Instead, he was alone in his apartment, probably crying and watching lesbian porn, and I was in the suburbs, pushing a baby around in a stroller. In the morning, Caroline and I fetched Mystery from the city. He hadn't shaved since I'd last seen him, and thin patches of stubble dappled his baby white skin. He wore a gray t-shirt that hung loosely over faded jeans. "Just make sure your family doesn't ask me to do any magic tricks for them," he told Caroline. Yet, that night, when Caroline's mother asked him what he did for work, Mystery launched into a spectacular performance. He introduced each illusion, mind-reading, bottle levitating, self-levitating, sleights of hand, with 10 minutes of patter and panache that put every other illusionist I'd seen to shame. He charmed everyone in the room. Caroline's mom was flabbergasted. Her younger sister was attracted, and her brother wanted to learn how to levitate chalk to freak out his teachers. In that moment, I realized that Mystery actually had the skills to achieve his dream of being a superstar daredevil illusionist. After Caroline's family turned in for the night, Mystery asked her if she had any sleeping pills. All we have is Tylenol number 3, which has codeine, Caroline told him.
That'll work, Mystery said. Just give me the whole bottle. I have a high tolerance.
Chapter 7. The next morning, Mystery lay slumped in the back seat of Caroline's car, wrapped in a blanket and shrouded by a hat pulled low over his eyes, still apparently knocked out from the 4 Tylenol he'd swallowed the night before. Beyond asking us to drop him off at his family's condo, he didn't say a word, which was rare for him. We parked and took the elevator to his sister's apartment on the 20th floor. It was a cluttered 2-bedroom hovel crammed with people. Mystery's mother, a Zoftig German woman, sat on a beat-up flower-patterned sofa chair. His sister, Martina, her 2 children, and her husband, Gary, were crammed into a couch next to her. Mystery's father was shut up in his apartment, 4 floors above them, sick with liver disease from a lifetime of drinking.
Hey, how come you don't have a girl with you?
Mystery's 13-year-old niece, Shaolin, chided him. She knew all about his girls. He often used his nieces as a routine to convey his vulnerable paternal side to women. He truly loved his nieces and seemed to come back to life a little when he saw them. Mystery's brother-in-law, Gary, played us some pop ballads he had composed. The best of these was a song called Casanova's Child, which Mystery sang along with at a near deafening volume. He seemed to identify with the title character. Being at home was slightly awkward for Mystery. His father, he had often told me in the past, was an alcoholic German immigrant who verbally and physically abused him and his mother. His brother, who is 14 years older than him, was gay, and his mother blamed herself for smothering his brother with love to make up for her husband's abuse. So, to compensate, she was emotionally distant from Mystery. When he was still a virgin, at age 21, he began to worry that maybe he was gay. So, in a bout of depression, he began formulating what would become the Mystery Method, dedicating his life to pursuing the love he'd never received from his parents. Caroline and I left his house after another half hour. The girls chased us all the way to the elevator bank, laughing and screaming, followed by Mystery. Suddenly, a door swung open, and a man in a clerical collar gave the girls a steely, condescending stare.
You shouldn't be making so much noise in the hallway, he said.
Mystery turned crimson.
What are you going to do about it?
He asked.
Because I think we should.
These are young girls. They're having fun.
Well, the Reverend said, they can have fun in a place where they're not disturbing other residents.
I'll tell you what, Mystery snapped. I'm going to get a knife, and we'll find out just who exactly should be in the hall when I get back.
Mystery marched back to the house as the rest of us exchanged concerned looks.
The Reverend slammed the door shut, and Caroline and I slipped away in the confusion. I didn't really want to go back to Caroline's. I've lived in cities my whole life. I hate the suburbs. My biggest fear is being bored or boring. Weekend nights weren't made for sitting around watching videos from Blockbuster, but Caroline couldn't stay in Toronto. She didn't want to be away from her son. She didn't want to be a typical teenage mother. So while Caroline played with Carter the next day, I checked my email. Mystery and I had posted a field report about Carly and Caroline a few days earlier, and my inbox was full with messages from kids I didn't know from North Carolina, Poland, Brazil, Croatia, New Zealand, and beyond. They were looking to me for help, just as I had once looked to Mystery. There were also 2 emails from Mystery. In the first, he wrote that he'd gotten into a fight with his sister over the hallway incident. She proceeded to punch me several times. I had to restrain her by grabbing her throat and flipping her to the ground. I then left to go back to my house. I wasn't angry. I just wanted to stop her from attacking me. Weird, huh? The second one read simply, I'm cracking up. I'm hungry, my head hurts, my skin aches, and I've been choking it all day to internet porn. I'm going to get sleeping pills because if I stay up all night alone, I'll go nuts. I can't wait to disappear.
I'm so close to saying fuck it and ending it all. This living thing isn't fun anymore. He was losing his mind, and I was stuck in Bumblefuck, Ontario, watching Britney Spears and Crossroads with three teenagers, one of whom was supposedly now my girlfriend. The next morning, I had Caroline drive me to Mystery's place. "Can you stay with me?" I asked. "I should really get back to Carter," she said. "I haven't been paying enough attention to him, and I don't want my mom to think I'm being neglectful." "Your mom wants you to go out and be with your friends. You're putting this pressure on yourself." She agreed to come inside for an hour. We walked upstairs to Mystery's apartment and opened the door. He was sitting on his bed, watching Steven Spielberg's AI on his computer. He was wearing the same gray t-shirt and jeans I had last seen him in. There were scratches on his arms from his fight with his sister. He turned to me and began to speak. His voice was cold and dispassionate. "I've been thinking," he said. "The robots in this movie have motivated self-interest. They set objectives and then work to accomplish them. The child robot seeks protection and is mommy. The sex robot chases women. When he's freed from a cage, he sets out to mate with real women again because that's his objective." "Okay." I leaned against a computer desk, pushed flush against his bed. The room was the size of a large closet. The walls were bare. "What's your point?" "The point is," he said in the same deadened voice, "what is my objective? And what is yours? I'm a child robot, a sex robot, and an entertainer robot." On the floor in front of his bed was a half-eaten plate of uncooked spaghetti. Shrapnel from the spaghetti sticks was scattered around the room. Nearby were the remnants of a black cordless phone that had been smashed against the floor. The battery dangled helplessly out of the open back. "What happened?" I asked. "I blew up at my sister and my mom. They wouldn't shut up." When Mystery, or any Pua, was in a funk, there was only one cure for it: to go out sarging and meet new options. "Let's get peacocked and go to a strip club tonight," I suggested. Strip clubs were Mystery's weakness. He had a list of strip club rules that pretty much guaranteed him at least a phone number every time. Among them, befriend the DJ, never pay for a dance or a drink, do not hit on, compliment, or touch a stripper, stick to your material, and change the subject whenever a stripper starts reciting the stories she tells every other guy. "I don't want to go out," he said. "There's no point." He stopped the movie on his computer and began working on a half-finished email. "What are you doing?" I asked. "I'm emailing the students in New York and telling them the seminar's canceled." He spoke as if he were on autopilot. "Why are you doing that?" I was pissed. I'd put a month of my life on hold so we could go to New York and Bucharest together. I'd already bought the plane tickets. And now, because of some mixture of Steven Spielberg and codeine After Effects, he was bailing out. "Not enough people. Oh well." "Come on," I said. "You're already making $1,800, and I'm sure more guys will sign up at the last minute. It's New York, for Christ's sake. No one commits to anything in advance." "Living," he sighed, "costs too much." It was all too melodramatic for me. The guy was a black hole sucking up attention. Fuck him. "You're so fucking selfish," I seethed. "What about our tickets to Bucharest?" "You can go if you want. I'm canceling all shows, all agents, all seminars, all workshops, all trips. I'm stopping everything. I don't want to be known for being a Ross Jeffries." I gave his dresser a mule kick from behind. I have a long fuse, but when it hits bottom, I explode. Though my father may not have taught me much about women, he did teach me that. An orange prescription bottle hit the floor, scattering pills. I picked it up and looked at it. The word Rivotril was on the label. "What are these?" "They're my sister's antidepressant medication. They really aren't about dealing with depression so much as making me sleep." Cold. Clinical. I figured they couldn't be doing much good, so I left 3 in the bottle and stuffed the rest in my pocket. I didn't want him overdosing. Mystery logged on to Party Poker, an online gambling site, and started playing mechanically. The Mystery I knew was too logical to gamble. "What are you doing?" I said. But I didn't wait for an answer. Never mind. I slammed the door behind me and found Caroline in the front room. "Let's go back to your house," I told her. She smiled weakly, sympathetically. She didn't know what to say. In that moment, I hated her. She just seemed so useless. Chapter 8. So I went back to Caroline's house in the suburbs, to her mother and her brother and her sister and her son and her Britney Spears movies. I could tell I was becoming a burden to her and a distraction from her son, and she could tell she was becoming a bore to me. It wasn't her constant fretting over her son I minded. It was her complete lack of initiative. The days and nights spent imprisoned in her house, doing nothing, were getting to me. I refused to take time for granted. One of the primary rules of pickup is that a girl can fall out of love with you as quickly as she falls in love with you. It happens every night. The girls who start rubbing your chest and making out with you in a club in 2 minutes will leave you just as quickly for a bigger, better deal. That's the game. That's life in the field. And I understood that. During a workshop in San Francisco, I'd spent the night at the house of a lawyer named Anne. On her nightstand, there was a thin book by a guy named Joel Kramer. Unable to sleep, I picked it up and leafed through the pages. He explained the emotions Caroline and I were feeling best. We have this idea that love is supposed to last forever. But love isn't like that. It's a free-flowing energy that comes and goes when it pleases. Sometimes it stays for life, other times it stays for a second, a day, a month, or a year. So don't fear love when it comes, simply because it makes you vulnerable. But don't be surprised when it leaves either. Just be glad you had the opportunity to experience it. I'm very loosely paraphrasing, but his ideas reverberated in my head as I spent yet another night in bed with Caroline. I had originally memorized the passage to use as a routine. I never thought it would actually apply to my own life. Love was supposed to be something women chased, not men. I spent the next day juggling airplane tickets and travel plans. I kept my flight to Eastern Europe, but instead of watching Mystery hunt for bisexual slave girls, I decided to meet a group of Puas operating out of Croatia. I had been corresponding with one of them, named Bad Boy, since the day I joined the community. One of the reasons I became a writer is that unlike starting a band, directing movies, or acting in a theatrical production, you can do it alone. Your success and failure depend entirely on yourself. I've never trusted collaborations, because most people in this world are not closers. They don't finish what they start. They don't live what they dream. They sabotage their own progress because they're afraid they won't find what they seek. I had idolized Mystery. I had wanted to be him. But, like most everyone else, perhaps more than most, he was his own worst enemy. When I checked the seduction boards that day, there was one new message from Mystery. Its title, Mystery's Last Post. "I won't be posting here anymore. Just wanted to say thanks for the memories and good luck to you all. Your friend, Mystery." I went to Mystery's website, and it had been taken down already. It's impressive how quickly years of work and effort can be dismantled. An hour later, my cell phone rang. It was Papa. "I'm scared," he said. "So am I," I told him. "I don't know whether this is a cry for attention or the real thing." "I feel the same way as Mystery." His voice was distant and weak. "My life is going all the way down. All I am is game. I haven't opened a book since school started, and I need to get accepted into law school." Papa wasn't an exception. There was something about the community that took over people's lives, especially now. Before Mystery started doing workshops, it was just an online addiction. Now everyone was flying around the country, meeting and sergeanting together. It wasn't just a lifestyle, it was a disease. The more time you devoted to it, the better you got. And the better you got, the more addictive it became. There were people who were quitting their jobs and dropping out of school in order to master the game. Such was the power and lure of success with women. One of the things that attracts a woman is lifestyle and success, I told Papa. Imagine how easy the game would be if you were a high-powered entertainment lawyer with celebrity clients. By getting into a good law school, you'll be improving your game. Yeah, he said. I need to prioritize. I love the game, but it's become too much of a drug for me now. Mystery's depression was affecting not just his own life, but the lives of kids who looked up to him and modeled themselves after him. Some, like Papa, were still modeling him, even in his downward spiral. Everyone who gets too absorbed in the game is depressed, Papa said. Ross Jeffries, Mystery, me. I want Mystery's game, but not at the expense of life. The problem was that this epiphany was coming too late for Papa. He had already signed up for seminars with David X and David D'Angelo. All of it, of course, meant blowing off days of classes. My dad called yesterday, Papa continued. He's really worried about me. All I've been doing is game for half a year while ignoring my education, finances, and family. You have to learn balance, man. Pickup should just be a glorified hobby. It was wise advice. Advice I should have been following myself. After I hung up, I called Mystery. He wanted to give me his motorcycle. He wanted to give Patricia his computer. And he wanted to give several stage illusions he had designed to a local magician. You can't give away the magic tricks you've worked so hard on, I protested. You may want them later. Those are illusions. I'm not good at anything but bullshitting people. I never meant to be a bullshitter, so I'm stopping now. I didn't need to be a high school guidance counselor to recognize the warning signs. If I didn't take them seriously, I might regret it later. I couldn't turn the other way while my mentor walked off a cliff, even if it was a cliff of his own making. I once had a friend whose ex-boyfriend was always threatening to kill himself. One day she didn't respond to his cry for help. He shot himself on his front lawn an hour later. In Mystery's Lounge online, we had a valuable network at our disposal. The lounge linked together surgeons, students, bodyguards, movie directors, fitness trainers, software developers, concierges, stockbrokers, and psychiatrists. So I called Doc. Doc had discovered the community when Mystery signed up on a lark for a dating seminar Doc was conducting at the Learning Annex. Mystery listened patiently as Doc shared tips and tactics that were AFC stuff compared to the technology in the community. Afterward, he talked to Doc, who confessed to not being much of a ladies' man. So Mystery took him out for a night on the town, schooled him in Mystery Method, and gave him access to the lounge. Now Doc was a machine, with his own harem of women. His nickname came from his doctorate in psychology, so I called him and asked for advice. He suggested asking Mystery the following questions, in exactly this order. Are you so down that you just feel like giving up on everything? Are you thinking about death a lot? Do you think about hurting yourself or doing something destructive? Are you thinking about suicide? How would you do it? What keeps you from doing it? Do you think you would do it within the next 24 hours? I wrote down the questions on a sheet of paper, folded it in quarters, and put it in my back pocket. This would be my cheat sheet, my routine. Chapter 9. When I arrived at Mystery's place, he was in the process of dismantling his bed. His movements were mechanical. So were his responses. What are you doing? I'm giving my bed to my sister. I love her, and she deserves a better bed. Are you so down that you just feel like giving up on everything? Yes. It's the futility of it. It's mimetic. If you understand mimetics, then you understand that it's all futile. There's no point. But you have a superior intellect. It's your duty to breed. It doesn't matter. I'm going to weed my genes out of existence. Are you thinking about death a lot? All the time. Do you think about hurting yourself or doing something destructive? Yes, this living thing is FUBAR. Are you thinking about suicide? Yes. How would you do it? Drowning, because it's what I'm most afraid of. What keeps you from doing it? I have to give away all my stuff. I dropped Patricia's computer and broke it, so I want to give her mine. She needs a computer. Did she care? No, not really. Was she mad that you broke it? No. Do you think you would take your life in the next 24 hours? Why are you asking me all these questions? Because I'm your friend and I'm worried about you. The doorbell rings. Who is it? Hi, this is Tyler Durden. I'm here for Mystery. I'm a fan of his posts and I want to see if I can meet him. It's probably not a good time right now. But I came all the way from Kingston. Sorry, man. He can't see anyone. He's sick. Chapter 10. I left Mystery in his room, went to the kitchen, and dialed information for his parents' number. His real world name was Eric von Markovic, but that was just another illusion. He'd legally changed it from his birth name, Eric Horvat. The phone rang once, twice, a third time. A man picked up. His voice was gruff, his manner curt. It was Mystery's father. Hi, I'm friends with your son Eric. Who are you? I'm Neil, Eric's friend. And I wanted to... Don't call here again, he barked. But he needs... Click. The asshole hung up. There was only one other person I could call. I returned to Mystery's room. He was washing a pill down with a glass of water. His face was red and twisted, as if he were crying invisible tears. What did you just take? I asked. Some sleeping pills, he said. How many? Fuck. I was going to have to call an ambulance. Just two. Why'd you take them? When I'm awake, life sucks. It's futile. When I'm asleep, I dream. He was starting to sound like Marlon Brando in Apocalypse Now. I dreamed last night that I was in a flying DeLorean, like the one in Back to the Future, and there were all these wires around us. I was with my sister, and she was driving. We went above the wires, and I saw my life below them. Listen, I said, I need Patricia's phone number. The tears came now. He looked like a big baby who was about to kill himself. Can you tell me Patricia's phone number? I asked again, slowly, gently, as if speaking to a child. He gave it to me, slowly, gently, like a child. I hoped that Patricia wouldn't hang up on me, that she hadn't cut Mystery out of her life entirely, that she'd have a solution. She answered on the first ring. As a girlfriend, she had been taken for granted by Mystery, but in reality, she was part of an invisible support system. Her stabilizing effect wasn't noticed until she was gone. Patricia's voice was a little masculine, with a light Romanian accent. She didn't seem overly intelligent, but she cared about Mystery. There was compassion and concern in her voice. He's tried to kill himself before, she said. The best thing you can do is call his mother or his sister. They'll probably put him in an institution. Forever? No, just until he gets through it. The door to Mystery's room swung open. Mystery emerged. He walked past me toward the door. Hey, I yelled at him. Where are you going? He turned back for a moment and looked at me through blank, emotionless eyes. Good knowing you, buddy, he said, then turned away. Where are you going? I repeated. I'm going to shoot my father and then kill myself, were his last words as he opened the front door to the house and closed it gently behind him. Chapter 11. I chased after Mystery. He was descending the stairs slowly, as if sleepwalking. I shot ahead of him and barred the lobby door in front of him. Hey, I tugged at his sleeve. Let's go back upstairs. I talked to your sister. She's coming to get you. Just wait a couple more minutes. He hesitated for a moment, unsure whether to trust me or not. He was so docile. He didn't seem like he would hurt a fly. I shooed him upstairs with gentle whispers of encouragement. As he turned and walked, I called his family again, using an alternate number that Patricia had given me. He'll be okay, I thought, as long as his father doesn't answer. His sister answered. She said she'd be there within half an hour. Mystery sat on a futon in his kitchen and waited. The sleeping pills must have kicked in. He stared at the wall and mumbled strands of evolutionary theory, memetics, and game theory. The conclusion of his mutterings was always the same, the words futile or fubar. His sister arrived with his mother in tow. The moment they saw him, they went ashen. I had no idea it had gotten this serious, Martina said. She packed him a suitcase while his mother brought him downstairs. He followed passively, dead to the world. They left the building and headed toward a car that would soon take him to the psychiatric ward of the Humber General Hospital. As Mystery's mother opened the door for him, a four-set of girls poured out of an SUV parked in front of them. For a moment, a spark of life flickered in Mystery's eyes. I watched him, hoping to hear him say those six magical words. Is this your set or mine? Then I'd know everything would be okay. But his eyes went dead again. His mother helped lower him into the car. She picked up his legs and moved them inside, and then slammed the door shut. I saw him through the glass, the smiling blonde foreset reflected against his face. His complexion was pale and bloodless. He stared blankly ahead, his mouth closed, his jaw set, his sharp labret piercing, angrily glinting in the cold afternoon light. The girls were looking at the menu of a sushi restaurant. They giggled. It was a beautiful sound. It was the sound of life. I hoped Mystery could hear it. Chapter 12. Mystery's breakdown triggered a crisis of faith and self-examination in the community. We were all submerged so deep in the game that it was fucking with our lives. Papa was failing out of school. A San Francisco PUA named Adonis had been fired from his advertising job when they discovered how much time he'd been spending on Mystery's Lounge. My writing had come to a near standstill, and a PUA named Vision had become so addicted to the seduction news groups that he gave his DSL cables to his roommate and ordered, "Don't give these back to me for 2 weeks." Meanwhile, the community was growing exponentially. More and more newbies were flocking to the boards. They were young kids, some of them still in high school, and they looked to us PUAs for advice on not just seduction and socializing, but everything. They wanted to know what college to apply to, if they should stop taking prescribed psychiatric medication, if they should masturbate, wear condoms, do drugs, run away from home. They wanted to know what to read, think, and do to be like us. The first person to turn to me for help was Screwdriver, who was notorious online for posting field reports about visiting prostitutes in Tijuana. He still hadn't slept with a real girl. Then came a note from City PRC in Rhode Island. Then came pleas from a dozen others I'd never met. They were all offering me money to teach them seduction. They wanted to fly in. They wanted to fly me out. They were willing to pay any price just to watch a real PUA in action. With Mystery confined to the psychiatric wing of the Humber General Hospital and Juggler so deep in a long-term relationship that he had taken down his website, the students were hungry. And somehow, I had become their new guru. All those posts where I'd shared my routines and discussed my nights out hadn't just been a way of learning and sharing. They'd also been a form of advertising. But seduction is a dark art. Its secrets came with a price, and we were all paying it. Whether in sanity, school, work, time, money, health, morality, or loss of self. We may have been supermen in the club, but on the inside, we were rotting. I was modeling myself after you and Mystery, Papa said when I called to check on him. I need to be me. I have so much potential for success and I'm blowing it all. I used to be a straight-A student. He planned to go cold turkey on seduction, and for starters, cancel the seminars he'd already signed up for. I'll also stop calling HBs until I get my life in order, he said,
referring to community slang for women. If they call me, I'll tell them I need to get my life straight before I sarge them. I choose life. I will not be game. You have to treat school and studying like you treat seduction, I told him. Yes, he said, as if he just had an epiphany. I will make study wings. I will make study pivots. I will fuck close my tests. That may be taking it a little too far, but good for you. I feel free, he said. Whoa. And I'd like to say that's how we all felt, that we all realized we'd become too consumed and came to our senses, that we put our lives in balance and got our priorities straight, that we relegated seduction to a glorified hobby. But there is a concept in hypnosis called fractionation, and it states that if a person under hypnosis is brought out of trance and then put back under, the trance will be even deeper and more powerful. And so it was with seduction. We all came out of it for a moment. We opened our eyes and saw the light of the real world. But then we went back under, deeper than we ever were before, and to an extent beyond what any of us could have imagined.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.